we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts. Welcome to Hard Facts, the show that gets to the heart of the matter with me, John White. Peace with Russia and war with China and Iran. This, in sum, appears to describe the foreign policy embarked upon by US President Donald Trump. Trump's increasingly belligerent and bellicose statements against China and Iran, and those of his team, have failed to generate the attention they should have. But considering the unyielding controversy Trump has managed to whip up over his domestic agenda over the course of his first few weeks in office, i.e. the so-called Muslim ban and its consequent overturning by US courts, the controversy surrounding his border wall with Mexico, his ongoing spat with a large section of the American media, and the anti-Trump protests that have been taking place across the United States and which evince no sign of letting up anytime soon, then perhaps this lack of attention regarding foreign policy should come as no surprise. Regardless, however, for those who had allowed themselves to believe that Trump's election represented a significant departure from a status quo of unipolarity, hegemony, and the imperialist policies of his predecessors, Trump's aggressive posture towards Iran and China must surely give pause for thought. Specifically on the issue of Iran, it's impossible to overlook the influence of Trump's national security adviser, Michael Flynn, a man who in the past has described Islam as a malignant cancer, is a sick religion that must be healed, and has consistently called for regime change in Tehran. This, by the way, is the same Iran that has played a crucial role in the war against Daesh and other Salafi jihadist terrorist groups in Syria and Iraq in recent years, alongside Russia and Syria. And this is the same Iran that continues to resist and challenge the regional hegemonic agendas of Israel and Saudi Arabia, both long-standing and key US Middle East allies. But focusing on China, which is the topic of today's episode, some are attributing Trump's posture to his reputation as a tough negotiator, with the objective of driving a hard bargain on trade with Beijing in the interests of American jobs and industry. Yet when we consider that Trump's amanuensis, his man Friday, his Loyola, Steve Bannon, has said previously that the US and China will be at war within 10 years, then the time for the attribution of benign intent when it comes to Trump's policy towards China has passed. I'm John White, and you're listening to another episode of Hard Facts. Well, joining me to discuss China, I'm delighted to be joined by James Bradley, author and China expert, who's joining me on the line from Ho Chi Minh City. James, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I think we need to make it clear at the outset that this regressive, and I'm going to set my stall out, I do believe it's a regressive policy towards China, does predate the Trump administration. It is indeed a hangover from the Obama administration with his pivot to Asia policy outlined in 2011, supported strongly by his then Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. Now, John Pilger, I don't know if you're aware of the documentary that he made and was released in December titled The Coming
War. I'm in it.
You're in it. Oh, fantastic. Well, you'll be aware of the article that John Pilger wrote to accompany the documentary, and he writes something very significant. And I quote, U.S. Secretary of Defense, that's the U.S. Secretary of Defense in the Obama administration, Ashton Carter, said that U.S. policy is to confront those who see America's dominance and want to take that away from us. He then goes on to write, for all the attempts to detect a departure in foreign policy, this, meaning Carter's view, is almost certainly the view of Donald Trump. Your thoughts, please.
Well, let's imagine that Apple got a new CEO, and he was different than Tim Case. He had different ideas, and he wanted to drive Apple in a different direction. The first day he would take over, he would still have to sell iPhone.
Yes.
The board of directors would make sure that next day he would still have to. Well, the business of the United States is war.
Yes.
And Donald Trump has to keep that wheel turning. And it's not a change. I mean, President Obama in 2015, he had a pretty good year. He dropped about 24,000 bombs.
Yes.
But then in 2016, he did a much better job as an American president. He dropped 27,000 bombs. He increased it quite a bit. Yes. That's about 72 a day. And so on Tuesdays, he would have meetings on who would die. So what's driving U.S. foreign policy, the business of America is war.
It's empire.
Well, the deep state, the military industrial complex, the empire, whatever you want to say, they need some war. So the business of China is business, and the business of U.S. is war. So if I took over Apple, I would have different account executives on different accounts. So Flynn's on the Iran account. I mean, look at the United States. We got to be afraid of Iran.
Yeah.
We've successfully sold this bill of goods to the American citizenry through the media for a couple generations. It works. Oh, now here, let's pull out the Joe McCarthy. You've got to worry about Russia and China. That always works. We make trillions of dollars off of those. So it's as if Mad Dog Mattis is the account executive over in Japan and Korea, making sure that Lockheed's missiles get installed.
Yeah.
Well, we've got to build a wall because Boeing and Lockheed have it budgeted.
Yeah. And what you identify there, I think, very cogently is the fact that regardless of who the president is, by virtue of that role, he become the CEO of a global empire. And Donald Trump has never once resiled from that role. He obviously is placing a different emphasis, i.e. he's offering peace to Russia and war with China. I wrote recently that there's something very calibrated about this emphasis, because if you consider the Nixon-Kissinger strategic policy of the early 70s, which exploited the Sino-Soviet split to make sure that the communist China could never unite with the Soviet Union, it was hugely successful from a strategic point of view, from Washington's advantage. And I do see a recrudescence of this, and perhaps in a different way. Obviously, this time it's peace with Russia and war with China. Do you give that any credence, or do you think it's less sophisticated than that?
Well, it could be. But the point is, the war drums have got a pound. We've got an army and a navy.
Yeah.
The navy needs China. The navy needs the United States to be afraid of China. I wrote a book called The China Mirage that demonstrated how China is seen as aggressive in the United States, but it's filtered through the U.S. media. China is not, we've got nothing to worry about in the South China Sea.
Exactly. I mean, China has one aircraft carrier compared to the United States, which has 19, 10 carrier battle groups, which each one is the equivalent of a national navy in size. So there you go. The threat really exists towards China from the United States, not the other way around. And it's interesting, though, isn't it, James, because China and the US, regardless of the strategic differences, they do enjoy a symbiotic relationship economically. The US is the largest market for Chinese export, and China, up until recently, was the largest foreign holder of US debt. So there is a very symbiotic relationship. And getting into what Trump claims, that China has been guilty of currency manipulation, well, the facts don't bear this out, because China's been offloading its holdings of US Treasury bonds. I think it's gone from $1.37 trillion down to $1.5 trillion in the last 3 years, which has increased the value of the yuan. So what do you think Trump's game is here? Do you think he's just using this as just yet another reason to attack China for strategic reasons?
I'll tell you a story. I went down to Darwin, Australia. Why? Because it's a huge port. It's the bottom of the South China Sea. If you don't control Darwin, Australia, the port, you can't control the South China Sea above it. The Chinese went there and the Americans went there. The Americans are there in a big base, Marines. They bring in guns and tanks and missiles and hard stuff. The Chinese came in business suits and said to the city of Darwin, we'll manage your port for 100 years. And they got the contract. So the Chinese are going with suits and ties to Rotary Club meetings in Darwin, while the Americans are behind barbed wire thinking about war. It's just a different approach, and the business of America is war. Trump and his account executives have got to keep the wheel turning.
Yeah, indeed. And obviously China focuses more on soft power. And the positive impact China has had on the developing world is inarguable. I'm looking here at a report that was carried in the South African Institute of International Affairs website, and it was written by Professor Chris Alden of London School of Economics. I don't know if you're aware of Chris Alden's work. And he writes in 2015, and I quote, "For Africa, an important marker of the transformation from a northern-dominated world to the rise of emerging powers was the global financial crisis beginning late 2008. The ability of the Chinese economy to weather the crisis, in contrast with the negative impact on the European and US economies, marked a fundamental shift in favour of leading developing countries like China African countries have sought to emulate China's development lessons and integrate these ideas into their own national planning programs. I mean, China's impact on Africa in the last decade and more has been seminal, hasn't it?
Yes. Once again, though, if you go to Africa on the ground, it's hard to see this in the media, you'll see Chinese businessmen. They're saying, we'll build you a railroad to get this coal out of here,
yeah,
and we'll do business. But you'll see Americans in uniform with guns.
Yeah.
And they need enemies. They need enemies in order to increase their troop strength, increase the money. I mean, it's crazy. The American approach is, but can I tell a story? I'm in Ho Chi Minh City.
Uh-huh.
And in a few days, I'll go back to an island here. It was a French penal island, 19th century, huge prisons. Well, America took it over with the Vietnam War, and a precursor to Halliburton, a company that's a precursor to Halliburton, was running it. So you have account executives in current day Halliburton, if they need to build a prison at Abu Ghraib in Afghanistan or something, they can look at the file. It's a profit center.
Yes.
The Vietnam War was not a quagmire. It was a profit center.
Yeah. It's a short window whereby they can sell weapons to other countries. And we obviously know U.S. arms sales to regional allies in South China Sea, the Philippines, Indonesia, Cambodia, South Korea have gone up exponentially over the last few years, ramping up this threat or the supposed threat from China. And specifically on the South China Sea's territorial disputes, we're talking about the Spratly Islands, which are man-made islands which China has taken control of and has proceeded to build landing strips and military facilities. What's China's claim on the Spratly Islands? Because it seems a little bit obscure, unlike the territorial dispute that's ongoing in the East China Sea with regards to the Senkaku Islands, as the Japanese call them, or the Diao Islands, as the Chinese refer to them. What's your analysis of the territorial dispute, specifically with regard to the South China Sea?
My analysis is that almost all the words analyzing it are a pile of garbage. China is the biggest power in Asia. The United States and other Britain and France traditionally came in, humiliated China through the South China Sea. John McCain was fished out of a lake in downtown Hanoi. He fell out of a bomber that was bombing people. Where did that come from? It came from the South China Sea. So Russia's just saying, hey, United States, be real. You've got the Caribbean. You know, no one can invade Bermuda. Uh-huh. You've got Alaska. I mean, you have your territory. You're a great power. And I have elbows. I'm China. Mm-hmm. And you can no longer have a nuclear-armed U.S. Navy ships up my butt. That we're going to have a perimeter, and that's the way it is, and that's the way it's been for thousands of years. So all the detailed analysis and the use of words and the legalisms, it boils down to China's doing what the United States and every other power has done.
Resisting U.S. imperialism in its own backyard.
Well, U.S. imperialism, but, you know, the Security Council, the top five countries in the Security Council, those are the top five arms dealers.
Yeah.
It's not just the United States.
Yes.
All our friends, France, U.K., they would all like to be the number one arms dealer like we are.
Indeed.
But wars are very profitable and business is good.
Okay, James, on that note, we'll stop for a short break. Please stay tuned and join me for my conversation with James Bradley, author and China expert, on Trump's foreign policy towards China. Don't go anywhere. Hard Facts. Well, welcome back to the second half of this episode of Hard Facts, where I'm discussing the Trump's policy, foreign policy, regards to China with James Bradley, who's joining me on the line from Ho Chi Minh City. But before we return to our conversation, we hit the streets earlier to find out what the public thinks. We asked, do you think Trump will take the US to war with China? Let's have a listen.
Well, anything's possible with him. He's very unpredictable, so yeah, anything's possible.
I think he's more talk and he's not actually doing anything. He's just speaking to get people's attention so he can do whatever he plans on actually doing eventually. I think Hillary's worse. Like, Hillary's actually killed children in Iraq. She's ordered these things to happen. Donald Trump just, I don't know, didn't pay his workers. It's not as bad.
I think the difference between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton is that Donald Trump gives a kind of heads up before he does anything. So he kind of mentions, I'm going to build a wall. Yeah. And then when he actually does it, people are like, oh, no way, he actually did that. He's not even a politician.
Yeah,
and maybe that's what the world needed. Someone who doesn't have a background in lying.
Yeah, I think what politics has been doing is very dirty, kind of concealing everything they're doing. And Trump's kind of bringing it all to surface. So now people can actually see what's going on. And of course they're angry, like politics isn't all fun and games. But now people are actually seeing the truth for what it is. That's all he's doing, in my opinion.
Between the U.S. and China? Well, we may go to war over these islands outside...
Say China Sea?
Yeah. But I don't know. Trade war is more likely. His first target seems to be Latin America. And I haven't heard as much about what he wants to do about China on trade. But it's coming. And we're out of the TPP, but that might actually soften things with China. I don't know.
Yeah, an interesting range of views there from the public. James, you made a very important point, I think, at the very beginning of our discussion with regards to the way that Obama was probably one of the most destructive presidents in recent history, even more so than George W. Bush. Yeah, he's been able to sort of ride off into the sunset and people lamenting the end of his presidency, painting him as some great progressive, even trying to cloak him in the colours of Martin Luther King, if you can believe it. Well, how do you account for this liberal hagiography when it comes to Barack Obama, given his record of bloodshed and war and destruction that he was responsible for?
It's okay if you do it overseas and keep it out of the sight of San Francisco liberals and, do the killing in the backyard, in the alley. Keep it out of the front yard.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. So it speaks to this, the U.S. exceptionalism, which is human life is graded according to which part of the world you come from. So if you're an Iraqi or a Syrian or an Afghan, your worth is less than that of a European or an American. Isn't it racism we're talking about here, James?
Well, my third book was about that subject. It's been going on for a few thousand years. But, I'd like to call attention to something Trump said to Bill O'Reilly.
Yes.
And it isn't what Trump said. It was O'Reilly's reaction. And this is what we're dealing with. Trump said, O'Reilly said, hey, Putin's a killer. And Trump said, we're killers, too. And the rest of the exchange has O'Reilly. We're not killers. Our presidents aren't killers. No, what are you talking about? He's out of touch. If our president isn't going to be a killer, Obama dropped 27,000 bombs. He looked at the names and faces of people that he was trying to kill for 8 years. There's more refugees running from American bombs now than were running from Hitler and Tojo in World War II.
Yes.
But that's not translated into the American populace. If you are an Obama who has approval of a certain class domestically, you'll be forgiven the kills. The kills are free.
Indeed. And that interview was very interesting, as you point out, because what happened there was Donald Trump succeeded in puncturing the bubble inside which the likes of Bill O'Reilly and people like him have cocooned themselves from the truth, from reality, smug with their own hypocrisy, their own sense of exceptionalism, and cocooned from the damage that they caused, not just in terms of supporting this imperialist juggernaut that's been rampaging around the world under successive presidents, but also the way that they've tried to justify it. As you say, I mean, when Bill O'Reilly made that statement, Putin's a killer, he did so with the insouciance of a man who was repeating the catechism. It's almost as if it's a received truth. Of course, Putin's a killer, but we're not killers. Our bombs are made of cotton wool. And any deaths that happen, collateral damage, they're mistakes. Again, we go back to this empire mindset that's poisoned the body politic in the United States and, by extension, in Europe. And we see it now being directed against China with the recrudescence of the sort of yellow peril, inscrutable Chinese racist tropes in recent weeks and months. And this is going to continue. How do you see this playing out? Do you believe there will be military confrontation? I mean, I did mention that Steve Bannon, Trump's man Friday, his number two, his top political advisor, has said previously that he predicts war within the next 10 years. What do you think?
Yeah, well, if Trump wins re-election, then Bannon's out in 8 years. And, what I think is that you have to talk like that because it's profitable. The Navy needs China as an enemy. The Army needs Russia, Iran. You've got to have the American public afraid of something for Lockheed and Boeing to be able to sell these jillion-dollar useless airplanes and missile systems that are surrounding China. You asked me about the John Pilger documentary. I'm in it. And in there is a great map where Pilger shows the 400 bases surrounding China.
Yeah.
So if you read the New York Times, you can see the islands that China is building, but you can't see the 400 American bases.
Yeah. I mean, interestingly, John Pilger, in the same article that I quoted from earlier, he goes on to write that in 2015, in considerable secrecy, the US staged its biggest single military exercise since the Cold War, called Talisman Sabre, blocking sea lanes in the Straits of Malacca in order to cut off China's access to oil, gas and other raw materials from the Middle East and Africa. China is obviously very vulnerable because it doesn't have any natural resources of its own. But I want to go back to the alliance, because both China and Russia are founding members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and in recent years they've forged very strong economic, military and strategic ties. Now, this is going to put Russia, I think, in a very difficult position down the track, because, as I say, Russia is obviously keen to foment positive relations with Washington, given what had gone before and given the threats that had been levelled against Russia and thousands of NATO troops, the missile defence shield, the demonisation of the Russian government, the ability of the United States to talk tough when it comes to terrorism while acting to really facilitate it in the Middle East and so on. But this is going to, I think, place Russia in a very difficult position, because it seems to me that Trump is making Russia, or is setting a scene, a scenario whereby Russia will have to choose between good relations with the United States at the expense of its relationship with China, or vice versa. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that Trump could try something like that, but China has knit Russia and the stands, all the Kazakhstans and whatever, together with this new Silk Road. I mean, here's one idea that might blow your listeners' minds. Probably, we don't know for sure, but probably within the next 12 months, China will add 1 billion people to the internet. These will be sheep herders along the new Silk Road when they lay the fiber optic cable. Mm-hmm. And, you know, China got its first train from Shanghai to London.
Yes.
The other day.
That's right. Yeah.
So it's knitting Eurasia.
Yes.
The game is not the South China Sea. The game is Eurasia between China and Russia.
Uh-huh.
And if the United States gets a percentage of the business, we'll be doing good. And if we continue to criticize and do boneheaded things with nuclear armed countries that are huge, bigger than the United States and proud, you know, let's get on with it. We can get along with these countries and it's a win-win.
Indeed. And rather than confront China, we should be trying to learn from China, because China has shown that globalization can work. China has benefited from globalization. It's lifted 500 million people out of poverty over the last 10 years. It's a remarkable transformation that's gone on in China. And as you say, it's developing at such a ferocious rate all over the world. And it's helping countries to develop. It's building infrastructure in Africa, in Southern Europe, all over the world. In Latin America, it's forging closer ties with other BRIC countries, Brazil, for example, where it's just agreed a massive deal for Brazilian oil in return for Chinese manufactured goods. Why do we need to go to confrontation? I think it comes down to the key point, which is that the United States is worried about its hegemonic position globally. It sees itself as a world empire, and like any empire, it's not going to leave the stage of history without a fight and without a struggle. So what we're really looking at is how we manage US economic, cultural and military, decline, but economic and cultural decline. It doesn't have the influence it used to have. And this is a desperate rearguard action we're seeing, I think, but it's very, very dangerous. So as I say, I think we're going to be looking at military confrontation sooner rather than later. And what would happen if the military confrontation was to erupt, James, given your knowledge of China? How would the Chinese people react? Would they unite, or would you see some sort of dissent against Chinese military confrontation with the United States? Do you think it's a confrontation that the Chinese can possibly win?
Nobody wants confrontation, and no one can win that. China could sink all our ships in a second, and we'd be in nuclear war. So China and the United States loses. So it's not doable. There's a lot of chest pumping, and there'll be a lot of knocking each other and heated words, but it'll take an incredibly stupid person to foment war between China and the United States.
Indeed. And just finally, James, the One China policy, which has come in for scrutiny, whereby the United States has acquiesced to China's depiction of Taiwan, not as an individual or separate independent state, but as a breakaway province of China. What do you think that does to the Chinese? How important is that policy to the Chinese, given what we discussed briefly, the century of humiliation in the 19th century where China was ravaged by Western colonialism? If you could just describe for the listeners how important that policy is to the Chinese.
Well, if the American listeners would, you know, give up Texas in a deal, how would you feel about that? I mean, no, Texas is, it's just not negotiable. Texas is part of the United States. Taiwan is part of China. And period. That's how Beijing sees it, and that's how it's going to be.
Well, James, on that note, we're going to have to leave it. We've run out of time. Thank you very much for joining us on this episode, and thank you out there for listening. And remember, until next time, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.